Goff in the shotgun. Gurley on his left hip. Takes the belt high snap. Back to throw. Has time. Throws to the near right side seam. Deflected and picked off.
Who else?
Intercepted by Micah Fitzpatrick.
Are you
He'll
kidding?
He'll take the knee at the 40-yard line. And this ball game is over.
The Rams were a high-octane scoring machine last season. Now, they're 5-4, and their offense has failed to get off the ground. After the team's loss to Pittsburgh, what went wrong? And can it be fixed? Then, why tonight's Seahawks-Niners game might rekindle the hottest rivalry in the NFL. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Monday, November 11th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Dell Small Business. All right, Bill, every Sunday we've been getting together at night to talk about the biggest story from the slate of NFL games, the story that everyone is going to be talking about all week. So naturally, I thought we should start by discussing new Falcons kicker, Younghoe Koo.
I don't know if you know this, Mina, but Younghoe Koo actually won me my high-stakes AAF Fantasy League.
Bill Barnwell is a senior writer at ESPN and the host of The Bill Barnwell Show, an NFL podcast.
So I'm a big fan of Mr. Koo already.
Yes, it was a win for you. It was a win for my mother, Sunmin Kimes, who texted me. She is thrilled that Korean-American kicker is back in the NFL and crushing it, by the way. He outscored the Saints offense today. In a remarkable upset for the Atlanta Falcons. But as much as I would love to discuss Younghoe, we're really going to talk about something that you and I, Bill, have been discussing really for a few weeks now, and that is the ongoing struggles of the Los Angeles Rams offense. So to put it in perspective, last year, they not only averaged more than 30 points per game, they ranked second in overall efficiency, according to Football Outsiders. This year, they were 18th, and that was before today's game. They lost to the Steelers 17-12. Jared Goff threw zero touchdowns, two interceptions, struggled from start to finish. So I'd like to ask you, where did the Rams' struggles on offense first begin?
Okay, so I think you have to go back to 2018. So you remember that Chiefs-Rams game that felt like it was the future of football. It was so exciting. Everyone remembers that game. It was awesome. It was fantastic. The Rams had their bye week. And then the following week, they played the Detroit Lions, who were pretty bad on defense last year. But for most of the game, they really slowed down the Rams' offense. And what they did was essentially play a six-man front, a 6-1 defense with six defensive linemen or linebackers on the front. The goal in running that sort of defense and stacking the line of scrimmage is to prevent the Rams from running what is sort of their core concept in the Sean McVay offense, which is the outside zone and then play action off of that outside zone. You stack the line, you get a defender in every single gap. So forcing the Rams to do things they don't really typically want to do on the offensive side of the ball. The Bears used it the following week and really just absolutely handed Jared Goff his worst game under Sean McVay. And then you fast forward a few weeks, the Patriots ran it really quite frequently in the Super Bowl. And that Rams offense was a mess in the Super Bowl. So since that Lions game, Jared Goff has not been the same quarterback. So it's been 17 games since that Lions game through to Sunday's loss to the Steelers. Over those 17 games, Jared Goff ranks 34th in the NFL in passer rating at 78.7. He's 31st in total QBR. He's worse than Eli Manning, Andy Dalton, Joe Flacco, Mitch Trubisky. That's the class Jared Goff finds himself in after, over the prior 17 games, he ranked third in passer rating at 109. He was 10th in total QBR. He was one of the best quarterbacks in all of football. Now, I mean, he looks like one of the worst starters in the league.
So all throughout the season, Bill, I've been watching defenses as they've done what you just described, the 6-by-1 front where they, you know, crowd the line like we saw in the Super Bowl. And you've seen a lot of NFL defenses just repeat this with success. But what struck me today was the Steelers didn't have to do that. At least to my eye, it didn't look like they resorted to that tactic very often.
Yeah. I mean, I went through every single play on the NFL's Next Gen Stats site. We don't have the All 22, that sort of eye in the sky coaches tape Sunday night. We don't get it till I think Monday evening is typically when it's going to show up. But we do have these sort of, you know, dots in the sky player tracking data. And there was really only maybe two plays all game where I saw something resembling the 6-1. So it really was not a factor in this game. Steelers don't need to do that. Their defense is so good up front, and that worked. I mean, the Steelers beat up the Rams at the line of scrimmage in this game.
Beltai snap, five-man rush under pressure. Goff hit as he throws. Gosh. That ball flutters ahead. It drops down. It's loose. It's scooped up. Minka Fitzpatrick running back up the right sideline of the 30. He's to the 20, and he's going to take it.
Bill, you mentioned that the offensive line struggled in this game. They were bad. They've been bad all season, right? Which is a stark contrast to last season when they were one of the best offensive lines in football, if not the best. And I've seen some criticism out there from people saying, wow, how could McVay and the Rams GM Lesnead not have seen this coming? Why didn't they prepare for this? But they did prepare for it. I did color commentary this summer for the Rams during the preseason and didn't get to see the starters, but I saw the two rookies they drafted. They were planning on starting two rookies last year who were reasonably high draft picks who have played. So the Rams have actually invested along the offensive line, but even if you invest, sometimes you can't predict certainly injuries or decline in play.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, Mina. You know, the Rams haven't had to deal with any sort of injury issues along their offensive line in the Sean McVay era. They've been really, really lucky is the word I would use in terms of their health. Not a single one of their starters on the offensive line in 2017 or 2018 missed a single game via injury. Now, you compare that to the rest of the NFL, that is like a dream. Offensive line coaches dream of having the same guys every single week for the entire season, let alone 2 years in a row. And this season already, we saw Joseph Noteboom go down with the torn ACL, was one of those new players you mentioned in the Steelers game. We saw two different players go down over the course of the game. By the end of the game, the Rams were starting guys who basically had no professional experience, guys who either were rookies or who were cast offs from other organizations playing key roles against one of the league's best pass defenses.
Right. Sometimes it feels like in the NFL, there's a very small group of quarterbacks who are incredible regardless of their circumstances. And increasingly, it seems like Jared Goff might not be one of them. That was a very gentle way of putting it by me. But this offseason, he signed a four-year, $134 million contract extension. Do you think the Rams regret that?
I don't know if regret is the word I would use necessarily, but they probably feel pretty uneasy about it. This is a team that has been very aggressive in years past about signing their young players as early as possible. They've signed multiple first-round picks to a deal after their third season, which is the earliest time you can make an extension for a first-round pick in the NFL. Jared Goff's cap hit in 2020 is over $36 million. It is a staggering sum. Even if you restructure, even if you try to reduce the cost, that is money the Rams are going to have to pay, and that is going to prevent them from investing in, for example, their offensive line or Andrew Whitworth, who was the sort of like the hipster name you would bring up if you wanted to try and seem really smart about who was one of the best players in the NFL who nobody talks about. They can't really afford to replace Andrew Whitworth with an upper echelon left tackle because they're not going to have the cap space. They can't add help on defense because they don't have the cap space anymore because Jared Goff, who was making about $8 million a year, is now making $36 million on the cap in 2020.
Well, obviously Jared Goff's not going anywhere this season. The offensive line isn't going to magically improve on its own. So let me ask you this. The Rams head coach, Sean McVay, you know, he had a reputation after last season as being the boy genius. What can he do? Has he made any adjustments to improve the offense?
Okay, so if you ask people around the NFL, Mina, there is a certain subset of, we'll say, conspiracy theorists who think Sean McVay is sort of not tanking, but certainly hiding his best stuff until the postseason, the real solutions he has, which I'm not going to lie, I'm pretty skeptical. I don't think anyone is quite that patient in the NFL, but we'll certainly see in the months to come. I think already, though, we're seeing two things he's done to try and change up the offense. Number one, he's using more crack toss, which is just to get the ball out quickly onto the edge in a running back's hands, kind of bypassing those linemen, sort of clogging up the middle of the field and tossing the ball out to a running back to get him one-on-one against a cornerback. Furthermore, in the passing game, they're working the quick game. They're getting the ball out of Jared Goff's hands quicker, not relying on that offensive line to pass protect quite as long as they were a year ago. But I think, honestly, this offense just kind of comes down to Jared Goff assuming that role and playing better.
Well, Bill, I hope next week we have a more positive story to discuss, like MVP candidate Younghoe Koo.
It's a wide open race, Mina. It would hurt, certainly, to see Russell Wilson not win MVP, but I think it's Younghoe Koo's time.
We'll be back in a moment. The best teams start with great talent, but finding the right people can be a challenge. I mean, just ask the New York Knicks. When it comes to hiring for your business, ZipRecruiter can help you find the right candidates for your team fast, from healthcare to manufacturing to business services and more. And now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/ESPNDaily. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 top job sites, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. You can even add screening questions to your job listing so you can filter candidates and focus on the best ones. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, to try ZipRecruiter for free, my listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/ESPNDaily. That's ZipRecruiter.com/ESPNDaily. ZipRecruiter.com/ESPNDaily. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Tonight, the 7-2 Seattle Seahawks and the 8-0 San Francisco 49ers are battling it out for NFC West dominance, a game that could reignite a rivalry that was once the nastiest in the NFL.
They hate each other. They don't dislike each other. They hate each other at every level. And every time they get talked about with one another, it's vicious. Mm-hmm.
The feud peaked in 2013, back when coaches Jim Harbaugh and Pete Carroll, who were rivals in college, were on opposing sidelines. And young quarterbacks Colin Kaepernick and Russell Wilson were duking it out. And the fans hated each other.
Just hearing about, you know, they have police staked out in the crowd because, you know, San Francisco fans and the Seahawks fans, you know, they didn't want any fights and people were doing all kinds of crazy stuff during the week.
Former Seahawks defensive end Cliff Averill last played in 2017. He now hosts a radio show on KJR in Seattle.
And that's when I was like, oh, wow, this is a real rivalry amongst the fans, let alone the players.
Cliff, you signed with Seattle in the spring of 2013. When did you get a sense that there was a real rivalry between these two teams?
Second game of the season. It was my actual first game that I played for the Seahawks because I missed the week one game. And the energy that we got that game was unreal. And you could just tell that they wanted to own the NFC West. And guess who else did? We did too. So I think that was more so the reason why it was such a big rivalry. Because if you look at their defense and then what our defense was doing at the time, I mean, it was smash mouth football all game long. And it was all about which team would break first.
After the 2013 season, the two teams meet in Seattle for the NFC Championship.
Wilson takes the snap, takes the knee. The Seahawks are NFC champions. We're going to the Super Bowl to play the Denver Broncos.
That matchup was amazing. I mean, it was unreal. You know, just the energy first and foremost. I mean, literally, we could not have been, if we were 2 feet away from each other, we would not be able to hear each other. You know, just the energy and the environment, the atmosphere. And to be honest with you, we felt like that was the Super Bowl. And then, of course, you know, you got Cap trying to make his plays and different things like that. So it was just all around basically an all-star team versus an all-star team, you know. And it was just, you know, and then there was little rivalries or little issues in between Sherm and Crabtree.
Describe that last drive batting the ball away for a game-clinching interception.
Well, I told y'all Crabtree was mediocre at best. So I would never let him catch a game winner on me. This is a joke, right?
You know, we knew whoever won that game after that bloodbath was going to win the Super Bowl for sure.
The next year, the teams play on Thanksgiving, and there's this infamous, memeable moment where after Seattle wins, Richard Sherman and Russell Wilson celebrate by eating a turkey dinner on top of the Niners logo at midfield.
You are a gracious guy, but right now we're sitting on the 49ers logo and you're eating turkey as a Madden player of the game.
I don't think Russell probably did that intentionally, but I can see Sherm, you know, kind of poking the bear a little bit, if anything. But nobody wants to see their opponent, especially, you know, a divisional opponent, a team that, you know, just beat you last year in the NFC Championship. You don't want to see anything like that on your field.
I think sometimes in sports we want these beefs to be real, right? But on the field, the players and the coaches, they don't really dislike each other. They're just doing their job. They want to win. But Cliff, it felt like these teams actually disliked each other.
No, I think it's more of the other way, honestly. I think it was, of course, the hype between the fans, both sides, you know, even when we went to go play in San Francisco, the hype between the fans, the hype, you know, the media hypes it up as well. But in all reality, like, we would see each other in the off season and hang out sometimes. You know, like, if you sat us all in a room together, there probably wouldn't be a brawl, probably wouldn't even be trash talking. They would respect each other as far as for that grind. But everything surrounding the teams, yes, that made it that much more of a rivalry than anything.
Throughout your time in Seattle, the Seahawks had the upper hand in the rivalry. Now, this year, the Niners are 8-0. Seattle is 7-2. What does this game mean for both sides?
It's huge. I mean, if you just look at the 49ers roster right now, especially on the defensive side, it's led by one of the original LOB members for the Seattle Seahawks and Richard Sherman. And if you look at their team, I said this earlier today, this week, actually. If you look at their team, they essentially look, and their philosophy looks like the 2013 team that we had here in Seattle. Really, really good on defense and run the mess out of the ball. They have three running backs that are playing really good football. You look at Russell Wilson and what he's been doing, and he's playing at an MVP level. And you look at his stats. I mean, we're talking 21 touchdowns, one interception, or two interceptions on the season. You know, be like, in order for them to be able to win this game, Russell Wilson's going to have to play well, but he's going up against an elite defense. And this is what's going to put Russell in that elite category if he's able to dominate these guys.
I mean, Russell Wilson is not exactly a trash talker. But do you think, you know, given the history here, that he would really relish a win in this particular case?
I'm not going to lie to you. Me knowing Russell Wilson, I don't even think he thinks about this type of stuff. Like, I think we hype it up way more than he'll ever process it or think about it. Like, for Russell, he's going to prepare like any other game. He's going to approach it like any other corner or any other defense. You know, he's going to see what they do well, what they don't do well. He's going to try to execute his game plan. I don't see him changing up who he is just because he's going against Richard Sherman.
Well, do you think Richard Sherman would relish this particular win?
Now, again, another guy that I know very well, yes. Sherman's the ultimate competitor, so for sure, he's gonna go out of his way. And now, also, I got to have to say this, too. Offensive players and defensive players have kind of different mindsets of what motivates them, how to make plays and different things like that. So I see Sherman definitely, you know, letting his guys understand and know who Russell Wilson is. But I also see Sherman, he's not going to do too much.
Thanks, Cliff.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it. It was fun. And this matchup, I think, is going to be pretty, pretty exciting to watch.
I'll be back with one more story. Whatever you want to protect, nobody has more ways to help keep you safe than ADT, the most trusted name in security. You can customize an ADT security package to help protect your home in a way that works for you and your budget. ADT has HD video doorbells, indoor and outdoor cameras, smart lights, smart locks, smart thermostats, flood sensors, fire and carbon monoxide detectors, all connected to 24/7 monitoring and controlled by the sound of your voice or the ADT app. So help protect your home today with ADT. Learn more at ADT.com/podcast. Here's another story I want you to know. On Saturday, The U.S. women's basketball team played the Oregon women's team as part of a college exhibition tour ahead of the Tokyo Olympics. The national team lost by 7 points. It was only the second time in history that they've lost to a college team, and it was the first time they've lost any game since 2014. Now, the U.S. women were missing a few of their stars, but even so, they still had veterans like Sue Bird and Sylvia Fowles on the court, but they were no match for Oregon, and in particular, for Oregon's brightest star, Sabrina Ionescu.
You know, I believed that we could do it. I never thought that I would say that we beat the best players in the world. And I think if we played again, the outcome might be totally different. But really proud of this team and our coaching staff and what we did tonight.
Now, if you don't know, Ionescu, who scored 30 points in this game, isn't just Oregon's biggest star. She should be the biggest star in college basketball, period. She's a fierce competitor, a dynamic ball handler, and a ridiculously gifted shooter, which is why last year she racked up her 18th triple-double, breaking the NCAA record. Here's what Steph Curry had to say about her before Oregon advanced to the women's Final Four.
Yeah, she's a legend in her own right, for sure.
Imagine what it must be like for a college kid to hear Steph freaking Curry call you a living legend. Like, if I were her, I would put that quote on a t-shirt and just wear it everywhere. Ultimately, Oregon lost to Baylor, who went on to win it all, which is one reason why Ionescu, who was a lock to go first in the WNBA draft, decided to come back to college for a senior season. As a result, Oregon, whose season kicks off today against Northeastern, is ranked number one. I'll be watching all year to see if they can go wire to wire, and to see if Ionescu can break even more records, like becoming the first college player ever to record 2,000 points, 1,000 assists, and 1,000 rebounds. I'd put that on the t-shirt too. I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.